Welcome to episode 43 of the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series as well as one prequel novel.
Sadly, in September of 2007, as he was working on finishing the series, Robert Jordan lost a long and hard-fought battle.
However, despite the loss of its creator, the wheel turns on.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of the Fourth Age podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. This is Andrew Gellos. I think we've got a great show for you this week. And with me, as usual, is Virginia.
Hi Andrew and hi everybody. And also we're privileged to have with us tonight, Jesse.
Hi everybody. Great to be here tonight.
So Andrew, what's our exciting topic for today? Whatever day it is, whatever time it is.
This podcast, I think we're going to switch it up a little bit and try to get into the meat of the main weapon of the Shanshan Empire, that being the Skuldam and Damane.
That'll be interesting. There's certainly a lot to talk about with them. By the way, everybody, there will be spoilers. So where should we start?
I think one of the most interesting things about them is that the original Aedam was created by an Aes Sedai, and of course her name is escaping me at the moment, but that she was collared herself shortly thereafter making it.
Oh, I actually knew that name, and now I've forgotten it.
Well, I'm looking for it.
I pulled that right out of my memory the last time we talked about it, and now I can't think of it at all.
Can't even find the stupid Shanshan in the light book now. The first Aedam was made by an Aes Sedai, Dain, who brought it to Luthair Paindrag in an attempt to curry favor with him. She knew he had no Aes Sedai in his armies, and for the most part, the Aes Sedai hated him. Dain believed that Luthair would eventually win and felt that she would be richly rewarded for bringing him a gift that could hand him the power of the Aes Sedai, willing or not. Several years after that, the first Suldam were found, women who could learn to channel and had the spark, but could... And had the spark? No, they didn't. Women
they
who could learn to channel and had the spark, but could not actually channel without training. These women were considered ideal controllers of the Damani, the Leashed Ones. For her trouble, Dain was rewarded with imprisonment by her own device. She was, after all, Aes Sedai, and thus not to be trusted. It is said that her screams shook the towers of midnight. Once the Aedam gained regular use, the title Aes Sedai disappeared completely from Shanshan, and those who could channel were renamed Marath Damane, or those who must be leashed.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite little sections about that, that for her trouble being just another Marath Dharani, that she was leashed herself. I thought that was kind of fitting justice for her betrayal.
I remember also thinking that that was very fitting justice. What kind of doesn't make sense to me about that, though, is that obviously, as we've seen, the Aedam does not release the one who is collared from the three oaths. So you still, if you were originally collaring only actual Aes Sedai, would not really be able to use them in battle the way that the Shanshan now do.
No, that was during the time of Offer Hawkwing, so they were taking the three oaths on the oath run. That's an interesting question. I guess there must be some way to get around that, perhaps by making them feel that they're in enough danger to be able to do it. Now, we haven't heard that yet, but perhaps the Shanshan also have their version of the oath rod that can remove the oaths, but there's no mention made of that.
Well, for original Shanshan Aes Sedai, there were no such thing as the three oaths. Even during the time of Luthair and Archer Hawkwing, the Aes Sedai who were in Shanshan were the native existing Aes Sedai who survived through the breaking of the world on that side of the Earth Ocean. They didn't actually come over with Luthair or anything because Luthair, being Archer's son, hated Aes Sedai with an extreme passion.
But then how could they have been part of the Aes Sedai hierarchy to call themselves Aes Sedai, because they would have had to have been part of the White Tower to be Aes Sedai, And I believe by the time of Hawkwind, they were they taking the oaths on the rod by the time of Arthur Hawkwind? That's a good question. I don't remember that either. I'm sorry, I thought they started doing that right after the breaking.
I believe that the Aes Sedai on this side of the ocean, or the side that most of our story takes place in, would have been, like you said, since the breaking, swearing on the oath rod. But what Andrew just said makes sense to me, that if they were Aes Sedai left in the territories of the Shan Chen from after the breaking, they might not necessarily have been in contact with the White Tower, but they still could have continued on their progress and continued calling themselves Aes Sedai.
Okay, I suppose
kind
so.
Of how the the Ogier who survived in Shan Chen through the breaking didn't develop the dependency upon the steading because they found a different way to survive the longing. They're still Ogier, but at the same time they didn't have that same affliction that happened on this side of the ocean.
I didn't ever really think about it, but I didn't realize that the Ogier from the Shan Chen were not subject to the longing.
Yeah, in an interview somewhere, I think Jordan said that they never had to find it again for some reason. Like, there was something different, and they just became kind of like a different subset of Ogier altogether.
Well, I'd like to know how they discovered that women who could be taught to channel could become Suldam. That seems very odd to me.
Well, I think, once again, because the culture developed differently than on Grand's side of the Earth Ocean, at a certain point, people became ignorant of the fact that some people could learn to channel at all. And it was more kind of like Emmons Field in the very beginning, where Moraine is explaining to everyone that there are different types. There are the people with the spork born in them, and then there are people who can learn to channel even though they don't have the just that natural raw ability that makes it so that they will channel regardless one day.
I guess my problem with the whole Dianne developing the Idom and the Shan Chen discovering it is that only a woman who can channel or can learn to channel can control a woman with the Idom. It does no good to anyone else, so lacking willing Aes Sedai to handle the Mereth Damani, and the willing Aes Sedai would also be called Mereth Damani, who were they planning to have control these women that were captured? If he didn't have Aes Sedai on his side, who was going to use the Idom on the Aes Sedai that they captured? I just don't understand that.
They may not have initially realized that was the case. And, obviously they realized that it could work for some people. They may not have realized that the why it worked for some people was because it was somebody who could learn to channel. It may have just seemed to them, well, it works on some people and it doesn't work on other people, which kind of seems to be the attitude that the current Shan Chen have, is that some women just can wear the bracelet and therefore they become Suldam, and some women the collar works on them, and so then they become the Mereth Damani. But they don't really give a distinction as to why some women can become Suldam and some women cannot. It's just kind of how they take it as it is.
I'm guessing that Dane was probably also being exceptionally Aes Sedai when she created it. I think she fully realized what she was doing when she created the device, but that she didn't tell anyone what the conditions for the person controlling the link was. I think she originally assumed that she would be like the leash holder for people, and that's probably how she demonstrated it originally. Because it says it took several years for them to find the first Suldam. So I'm imagining she probably knew that there were people who could learn to channel that could use the bracelet, but wouldn't otherwise be channelers. And then because the Aes Sedai were so factious and prone to infighting amongst themselves in Sandir, that Dane saw it as a way of gaining the upper hand against her fellow Aes Sedai. It eventually turned around and bit her.
Yeah, I suppose at some point in time she herself would have had to probably recruit either other Aes Sedai to go in with her and leash other Aes Sedai, or she would have had to recruit women who could use the Eidom, because otherwise, who was going to be putting the Eidom on her? Who was going to be shielding Dianne and leashing her, and then even if somebody physically grabs an Eidom and slaps it on her without a Suldam, or someone who can channel holding the bracelet end of it, she's stuck there within the confines of the length of the leash. She can't even move without going into nausea and cramps and extreme agony. So it just seems really kind of odd to me, sort of putting the cart before the horse, how they managed to get all these other people that were using the Eidom in order to trap Dianne herself. Maybe I'm making too much out of this. It just seems kind of strange to me how they managed that.
I really think it's just a matter that she knew the secret of how they worked, and she didn't tell anyone, and because she didn't tell anyone how they worked, that's how Luthair or his descendants were able to start using the women who could learn to channel, which society didn't know were what they were, to, you know, turn the tables on the one legitimate Aes Sedai that he actually had contact with.
Yeah, I can't see how else that could happen. It's pretty strange. It's a pretty cunning device.
It does really seem to be a very fitting end for her, though, at least in my opinion. I can remember being very excited to have read that she herself suffered in the same way that she had brought suffering to so many women.
And there are some characteristics of the Eidom that intrigue me greatly. One is that I realize that the Seanchan are basically using interrogation sort of techniques, mental domination techniques, to try and turn these women into willing Damani, to the point where they actually don't want to be freed and will run to a Suldam to be released if they are. And I'm wondering if that is perhaps a function, actual trait or function of the Eidom itself, you know, much as the Crystal Throne inspires unwavering obedience and worshipful behavior in people that approach it. Maybe the Eidom itself causes some sort of change in the person's actual mental outlook on things. And the other thing that the Eidom can do that really strikes me as odd, and I'm presuming that it's a function of the Eidom, but because Tuon mentions that Damani can tell fortunes, and she says this several times as though it's just a given and pretty much a fact that all Damani can tell fortunes, not just the ones that we know of over here. Aes Sedai, very few Aes Sedai have foretelling. So perhaps the Eidom confers some sort of additional ability to read the pattern as well. And what else might it do? I don't know.
I think that you're right a little bit. I think it is part of the function of the Eidom. But what I see the bracelet and collar doing, in my mind, is literally a version of forcing the power through a person in that conduit. Because on this side of the ocean, you have Aes Sedai who have to make throwing motions in order to hurl a fireball. And when they're collared, those throwing motions don't exist anymore. Literally, the Suldam is causing the weaves to leap into place, and there's no accompanying movements that are necessary because all it's doing is raw manipulation of the weaves themselves. And I'm not wondering if maybe the talent for foretelling isn't somewhat more common than anybody ever really realized, and that the Eidom just has a special way with the way it links to a person that helps bring that talent to the forefront, whereas in most people they would never have realized that they could do it without that particular type of encouragement.
That makes sense. I don't remember specifically when Tuon is referring to the fact that Damani can tell the future. I don't remember her saying that all of them could. I do remember, obviously, that she traveled on her way to Ibudar with one that could. And I kind of took that as to be something that not necessarily all of them could do. But I may just be misremembering that. But I think that would make sense if the foretelling really is just essentially a weave that you know, obviously people can form weaves without necessarily knowing how to make them, then, you know, if that's something that's happening where the Aes Sedai who do have the foretelling don't maybe necessarily realize that they are actually essentially channeling to do it. I don't remember now if any of the Aes Sedai have ever actually had a foretelling while they weren't already holding the power or while they weren't channeling for some other reason. Because obviously an Aes Sedai would know if she was channeling or not when the foretelling took her.
I don't think they're generally holding the power at all. I mean, I know Nicola was doing it, was holding the power when she did, but when Elida had her foretelling when she first met Ran, there was no mention of her holding the power at that point in time. Nor was there any mention of Gitara Morosa holding the power when she had her foretelling about the Dragon Reborn's birth and then fell over and died. So I don't know that it's essential that they be holding the power. As far as the prevalence among the Leashed Ones, I'm relying heavily on a comment that Tuan makes to Matt when she reveals to him why she knew that he would be her husband, and she tells about Lydia's foretelling, and she makes a comment to him, you know Damani can tell the future, right, sort of thing, and he sort of agrees because he knows that Aes Sedai can. I guess he doesn't even realize that it's that common or not. Actually, Matt knows shockingly little about Aes Sedai, considering how much he's with them all the time, but she just basically says, as far as I can tell, in Knife of Dreams, you know Damani can tell the future, and then she proceeds to tell him about Lydia's foretelling with the beware the man who will capture you and set you free, and beware the man who's seen Hawkwing's face, and the fox that makes the ravens fly, and all that stuff. So I guess my point is that it makes me wonder if being leashed by the Aedom doesn't, if not confer some abilities on the Leashed Ones, perhaps stimulate the development of latent abilities in other ways that we don't know, and then what else might we not know about that might we might find out later, you know, perhaps in the last battle. I actually don't remember the Aes Sedai that are leashed don't use the same gestures and weaves that they did before they were leashed, but it would seem odd to me that the Suldam would be forming the weaves for them because they all firmly believe they can't see weaves. You remember all that business in Winter's Heart and so on about they would deny, you know, a million times that they could even see the weaves being formed, although some of them will admit to themselves that they almost think they can see weaves. But the Suldam that have been Suldam for a long time almost thinking they could see weaves is a really far stretch from actually forming the weaves and forcing it through the Damani. I'm not sure where the Damani learn the weaves if the Suldam don't teach them. That's an interesting question to me.
The way I understand it to work, the Suldam is thinking of what she wants the Damani to accomplish. It's the same way with their punishments, where, you know, she thinks about the Leashed One feeling, you know, nettles being wrung across her back, then that's what she feels. And it's the same idea, is that the Suldam is thinking, I want there to be a fireball, and the Aedom is translating that so that the Damani then creates the fireball. And so in a way, it is kind of a second-hand creation of the weave, because the originating thought behind the action doesn't come from the person who is collared, it comes from the person wearing the bracelet.
We know that the Aedom basically creates an unwilling circle between the Suldam and the Damani, so that the, you know, Suldam obviously is in control of the circle, and I've always kind of took it to believe that the Suldam was actually creating the weaves, even though she may not be realizing that she herself is weaving. If you think back to when Rand and Ishween and most of the main characters were just beginning to learn to channel, there were times, especially with Rand, for example, where he would channel something and not see weaves and not realize that that's what he was doing. He would just think, you know, an example is when he's trapped in the room, I think it's in Four Kings with Matt, where he thinks, I need to get out of here right now and lightning will strike the window. It's, you know, not necessarily that he thought, I need there to be lightning right now. It's that he thought with such urgency while he was holding the power, unrealizing it, that he actually channeled. And I've always kind of taken it to be that the Soldam is actually the one who is really guiding the Weaves, even though she's not necessarily aware of the fact that that's what she's doing.
I can't really disagree with that, but then that's a little bit at odds with all the business in New Spring about Moraine and Siwan and the other accepted trying to learn their Weaves in order to test for Aes Sedai, when they're basically having a really difficult time continually forming these Weaves exactly right and in the right order and everything. There's a lot of study, and there's no question that channelers can pop up with Weaves instinctively under pressure or by accident like that. But it seems to me that for the main part, it's hard work and repetition that teaches them the Weaves. So it seems difficult. I find it difficult to accept that a Soldam is instinctively guiding Weaves through a Damani, especially if it's a Damani that wasn't previously an Aes Sedai and already knew how to channel. I know it works, and that's the way it is, but it seems odd to me that that's the way it happens. I'm not expressing that very well, but...
No, I see what you're saying. I do think that there's that weird possibility that, again, it's a function of the Adam itself, because we know the Damani live for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and we have to assume that maybe the Soldam live a little longer than normal people, but we don't really get an indication that they have that same extended lifespan. So as far as knowing the Weaves, you wouldn't necessarily have to if the Adam carries that function that it is what is controlling. It's basically in some way reading the Soldam's mind so that someone much less experienced with the power has access to the reserve of, you know, a 900-year-old channeler who does know how to create fireballs and lightning and, you know, all sorts of different things. So I think that might be how it works. It's a tenuous thing because we don't have a direct yes or no anywhere to say, yes, this is exactly how this works, or no, it isn't. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting question.
And going back to what I was saying a moment ago, I don't think that it's necessarily instinctive. I do think that there is probably a long training process that the Soldam go through. The Shon Chen seem to be very rigorous in their training and their building of their empire and their kind of administrative and bureaucratic governing techniques. So they really probably do have to put the Soldam through, you know, extensive training. And like Andrew said, you know, if they're pairing up a new Soldam with a Damani who's been leashed for hundreds of years, then that may be just a part of the training. I don't think it's that they necessarily instinctively know how to do it. I think that they, once trained, are able to do it without realizing that that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I can see that, and I mentioned that they have Damani also showing other Damani how to do the Weaves and everything once they're in training, and the Soldams as well. And the other thing about the instinctive Weaves that Rand and Egwene and some of the other channelers that we know of have come up with is, I think that's explained by the fact that when you're talking about Rand coming up with something instinctive, you're talking about the Dragon Reborn. I know that in the beginning he's raw and untrained and everything like that, but this is one of the most powerful channelers of the age, and the same can be said for Egwene, Nynaeve, and Elaine. They're in the top percentiles of the channelers, and so it seems much more likely to me that if there would be something instinctive coming through with them, it would come to the people that are the most gifted in that respect. And then others, you know, like Siwan and Moraine, who are obviously good channelers, still have to go through the rigorous and arduous training to come up with almost anything. Although, you know, most Wilders do have some little weave of their own that they've discovered. I mean, obviously somebody's got to be able to discover weave spontaneously, or none of them would ever know any of them. But I think it's a real learning process akin to going through, you know, your college degree in order for the most of them to really learn all of the weaves that they need to do under duress. And most of them, once they see a weave, the really good ones, you know, like Loghain and some of the others, they see Rand perform a weave like the Death Gates or the Blossoms of Fires, they just pick it up. You know, the same thing with Avienda and Olivia and stuff like that. The good ones pick it up just by watching it once. I did find the quote in Knife of Dreams where Tuan references Damani telling fortunes. It's on page 808 of the American paperback. she's talking to Matt about the eelfin, and he's telling her about the Tarangriel and how he knew that he was going to marry her and everything. And he tells her, I answered your question, Tuan, so you answer mine. And she says, you know that Damani can tell fortunes. And she gave him a stern look, likely expecting him to call it superstition, but he nodded curtly. Some Aes Sedai could foretell the future, why not a Damani? And she says, I asked Lydia to tell mine just before I landed in Ebudar. And this is what she said. And then she proceeds to tell him about Lydia's foretelling concerning Matt. So, to me, she just says, you know Damani can tell the fortune. It sounds like it's very common, not just your occasional rare thing that might happen the way the foretelling with the Aes Sedai is.
I do kind of have a slight theory on that as well, and it comes down to certain talents seem to get selected by preference. Robert Jordan, in previous interviews, has confirmed that channeling is a genetic thing, and that basically, if you follow that particular theory, the abilities that are used more commonly or proving to be more favorable are the ones that are more likely to get selected and passed on to future generations. Some things are very, very, very rare in Shanshan that are a little more prevalent on this side of, or on Rand's side of the ocean. Foremost amongst them is healing. And when you really think about it, at the very beginning of the Shanshan culture, they had a great need to be able to, predict their enemy's strategies, and they considered wielders of the power to be inhuman, and therefore the need to use healing wasn't used at all. I mean, as a matter of fact, it was one of the things that they never bothered to teach them, even though any Aes Sedai can do basic field triage healing. And so I'm thinking what happens is that Rand's side of the ocean, the Aes Sedai see the need for healing, and there isn't a great disposition against it, so they are doing a lot of healing, and therefore it's more likely to appear in future generations of Aes Sedai, whereas in the Shanshan culture, it's not. But things where it would be strategically important, like combat-type experience, or in this case, possibly being able to foretell the future, might be more necessary and more favorable, and therefore they might have a higher selection rate when you pass it on to the next generation.
That makes a lot of sense.
It does.
Another example of that would be that in Shanshan, obviously, the Damani must be able to make more Idam, and they obviously are making Tarangriels, a talent that has been lost on Rand's side of the ocean for, I don't remember now exactly, but if not hundreds, thousands of years, basically almost lost with the breaking. So that would be just kind of another indication to really prove that point, that it is just kind of selective into the areas that over 3,000 years the different channelers have evolved different traits.
Yes, and that made me think, too, of a comment that Tuan said about the same period of time where Matt is injured, and Tuan says that he should accept healing, and she mentions to him that this healing is a wonderful thing. My Mylan knew how to do it, and I taught the others how to do it. So that kind of goes with your theory, Andrew, that the Suldam are actually, in a way, controlling the weaves for the Domani, because if Mylan, the captured Aes Sedai, I forgot her name, Rima, that now belongs to Tuan, if she's the one that knew the healing, and then by her knowing it, Tuan was able to then either have, she said she taught it to her others, but maybe she had Mylan teach it to the others, I don't know. But anyway, it seems to me that there's definitely support for your position there.
I seem to remember there was an interview with Robert Jordan where they were asking him a whole bunch of different questions like that, and I just remembered them asking how there seemed to be people in the Wheel of Time universe who are able to enter the Kodi, that state of oneness that Aes Sedai and male channelers need to enter into in order to be able to channel, and they were asking whether or not it was possible, even without the genetic component, to enter a state of enlightenment where you might be able to learn to channel even though you weren't born with the ability in you. And Robert Jordan said, no, while the state of mind, that serenity or that oneness or that particular frame of existence needs to be there in order to channel, if you don't have the genetic background, you're just never going to be able to hurl fireballs or lightning or, you know, listen to things really far away.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that he confirmed that, because it always seemed pretty evident to me from things that were said in the earlier books that there was a definite genetic component to it. I mean, it was just reconfirmed over and over again with virtually every new set of channelers that we met, from the sea folk and everyone, so I'm glad to hear that. And, of course, I agreed with the white that they were probably culling the ability to channel out of mankind by gentling all the male channelers. And then, of course, we have the example that Grendel brings out of the Ayyad in Shara, where they're specifically bred together, where women who could channel have their faces tattooed and they can only have children with men who could channel who are killed in their 20th year or whatever. So, I mean, they've actually got a breeding program going on there, and how that will ever impact Rand's part of the Wheel of Time world before the last battle, I don't know. I can't imagine why he would have brought them up if they weren't going to have some impact, but that's something I don't know. We'll find out. Does it say who developed the male item, the sad bracelets? Does it give any clue as to the creator of those?
Well, I was interested in that because as we were talking here, again, I was kind of letting my own thoughts wander, and it occurs to me that when Nynaeve first comes upon the male Adam in the Panarch's palace, Mogedion appears to her and tells her what they're for. And I suddenly am thinking to myself, how does one of the Forsaken know what that thing does? Unless she's tested it, or unless something of its sort did exist previously, as in the Age of Legends. I'm not wondering how original Dane's creation of the original Adam was.
Well, I had always kind of assumed that that was something that may have been created during either the War of the Shadow or the War of the Power, when male channelers were starting to essentially go insane, and that the female channelers who were still then able to create Tarangreal may have tried to create something in order to either control or help them.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear it must be a relic of the Age of Legends.
One other interesting thing that triggered me to think of was that at one point through the hunt for the Black Ajah that's going on in the tower, learned that the Black Ajah will actually force a member of their Black Ajah into an unwilling circle for the purposes of punishment. And I was thinking that that must work fairly similarly to the way that the Idam allows the controller of the circle to basically punish the one who is wearing the collar.
Yeah, that's a thought. I don't know if they possess anything like that or not, or they're just doing it as a circle.
I believe the reference that I'm remembering, and I think it may be Pavara or one of the other ones that is actually hunting the Black Ajah, mentions that that is something that one of their Black Ajah captives had revealed. And I think it may be, and I might be confusing my Aes Sedai right now, but I think it might be Talene that actually revealed it to them, that if she were to go to the summons when she had been summoned before the Supreme Council, if it was for the purposes of being in trouble, essentially, for having revealed what she had revealed, then she would be punished and that they would use a circle to do it.
It was Talene, I'm sure, that revealed that, and I do remember that reference, and I don't think there was any mention of any Tarangreal or anything involved. I think they just bringing them into the link, and of course, that seems odd to me because it's mentioned when Egwene joins the link in Salador that there's a sense of oneness and sameness between everyone in the link, so that seemed like it'd be pretty unpleasant for everyone involved unless they've discovered some way to shield all but the one being punished. I'm sure the Black Ajah spent a lot of time on that sort of thing.
Well, I think in addition to the sense of oneness and sameness, that they also have the little ball of sensations in the back of their head that is the other members of the link. So if you can manipulate that ball of sensations, which Maybe nobody on this side of the ocean has tried to do that yet, except maybe the Black Ashad, that if you could manipulate that, you could essentially cause pain or inflict pleasure or whatever you so desired.
In the same way that an Aes Sedai can influence or suggest courses of actions to their warders, which is also described as being a bundle of sensations in the back of the mind.
Yeah, there are a lot of similarities between these different types of links and rings. That we did explore that a little bit in one of our episodes, I remember.
Incidentally, just as a side note, I was looking at a few things here, and my earlier quote about the genetic component of the Aes Sedai actually came from a joint interview that was conducted at Comic-Con by both our own DragonMount.com and Tarvalon.net.
Oh, excellent. That's good to know.
So, thank you to both DragonMount and Tarvalon.net for that particular interview, which reveals a number of things, including the tune which Robert Jordan had in mind when writing the lyrics for Dance of the Jack of Shadows.
And what was that tune?
The song is Gary Owen, which is, if I am not mistaken, the theme song for the U.S. 7th Cavalry.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, that's a good piece of information to know, since we see that song a lot in this book.
Let Barker sons be not asleep, but join with me each jovial week. Come booze and sing and let it ring to help me with the chorus. Instead of spa, we'll drink the beer and pay the reckoning on the deal. The man for debt shall go to jail from Gary Owen in glory.
We are the boys who take delight in smashing the lyric light at night, and through the streets like sports just fight, and tearing all before us.
Instead of spa, we'll drink the beer and pay the reckoning on the deal. The man for debt shall go to jail from Gary Owen in glory.
And for anyone who's interested, I did also find the quote where Tuon refers to Mylan, her Damani, knowing the healing. It's on page 592 of Knife of Dreams, the American paperback version. And she says specifically that this healing is a wonderful thing. My Mylan knows it, and I taught it to my others, too. And I thought that was kind of a peculiar way to phrase it, but it may be that she had her Mylan teach it to the others, too. I'm just not sure how many of these weaves the Sulam actually really do know themselves. I suspect a lot more than they'll admit to themselves. I find it very interesting that Tuon is revealed as having been a Suldam, or able to perform the function of a Suldam so that she can train her own Damani. That, to me, is just a little added strangeness to the Mat-Tuon relationship. I wonder how that's going to play out in the future.
Well, going back to her comment about that she taught it to her others too, if you look at how the Suldam-Damani relationship works, it's kind of like if you have two dogs and you teach one of your dogs to sit, and your other dog learns to sit, whether it's by watching you make the first dog sit, or whether it's because you sit there and you work with them and you give them treats and then eventually they sit, you're still going to say that you taught your dog to sit, not necessarily that the dog learned to sit down. And even though that's really what's happening, is the dog learned to sit down, but you're going to say that you taught them.
That's a really good point, actually. Being a dog breeder myself, that's pretty much exactly what they do. One of the quickest ways to teach one dog something that another knows is to have the new dog observe it. They're very imitative in that way. Not that the Damani are necessarily dogs. They're humans like all of us. But certainly the Shanshan treat them exactly like dogs, so I'm sure the training methods get used pretty much the same way. Kind of scary when you think about it. It's a lot like compulsion, really, taking away a person's will and self-determination completely. And making them want to stay that way, that's the scary part, sort of the Stockholm Syndrome in the Wheel of Time world.
Well, I think Tuon might also be a slightly special case. We know through discussions in Knife of Dreams that Tuon is aware of the fact that Suldam can learn the channel. When that news is quote-unquote revealed to her in Knife of Dreams, her reaction is not surprised at all. As a matter of fact, she's like, yes, just because I can learn to channel doesn't mean I'm going to. And I really do think that the Imperial family itself might be fully aware of this particular knowledge and might utilize that in its own particular special way in order to kind of guide the course of events. And in which case, Tuan might have a special pride that she can say, I taught my Damane to channel, or to do these weaves. And it might just be that thing that, yes, she's not actually doing the channeling, but she's making it come about, and therefore, you know, she kind of has that extra little feather in her cap, so to speak.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that, although I have to say what Jesse said makes a lot of sense to me. That's exactly the way you refer to it when you teach your dog something. I taught my dog that, even though you didn't sit down and perform the functions to show the dog. You instigated the training procedures and reactions to make the dog learn it, and you say, I taught my dog to do that. And I think that's pretty much the way they look at them.
I totally agree with that. I definitely think, given the way that the Damane are treated in Shanshan society, definitely reflects that same sort of training regimen.
And I have to agree with you. I've thought myself that the Imperial family may know more about all this than they let on. It may be a deep, dark secret known only to the High Blood, or perhaps only to the Imperial family, that the Suldam actually can channel, because that knowledge just can't have been completely lost. And surely other people must have discovered over the years that Suldam actually can channel. And I cannot imagine that a Suldam, say, under duress or under attack or pain or anger or something like that, didn't just pop up and channel the way Bethaman and Seda did with the Aes Sedai and the thing. It's got to have happened many times over the years and just been hushed up because they don't want it widely known.
I think that the attitude that Tuan has, though, really gives a lot of insight into that, and I did just read that particular part of Knife of Dreams, and while I don't remember her exact words, it is something to the effect of, but I can choose, and I think she goes on to say, you know, the same way I choose not to steal or not to commit murder, I can choose not to channel, and that is what makes me different. And really, I mean, the knowledge, like Andrew said, does not surprise her in the slightest. It seems like it's something that definitely the Imperial family knows, and it seems to me, although it may not even be that closely of a guarded secret, because if you remember when, as she refers to herself now as Lelwyn, or Eganon, is in, the name is escaping me, with Elaine and Nynaeve, that she initially, you know, upon discovering that, thinks, well, either A, it can't be so, or B, that seems really odd. How could Suroth herself possibly know this? But it's only really upon getting to know Elaine and Nynaeve that she really discovers why it's such a bad thing, because she gets to the point where she no longer feels that any woman who can channel really needs to be collared. And I think it's that thought that really is more important in the Shanshan Empire of keeping their powers, that every woman who can channel needs to be collared. Not so much that the Suldam could choose to if they chose to, because they know that they're not going to, because it's so ingrained in them to not want to be somebody who can channel, because then they themselves would need to be controlled. Did that make any sense at all? Because I just rambled on forever there. Wow.
It made sense. The only thing that kind of goes against that is that when Aegon, now Leolwyn, did learn that sometimes people can learn to channel and they're not automatically born either a channeler or not a channeler, she kind of flipped out. She means, you mean it can be learned? And I mean, it was just a total shock to her that it wasn't just either you are born and one day you will channel, or you'll be born and you'll just never touch the source at all. So it's kind of one of those things that I think it's kind of been a greatly hushed up secret. I do kind of envision, you know, much like Virginia said, where under duress maybe a Suldam separated from a Damane suddenly channels and someone happens to notice it. If word even manages to get back to the Imperial family and that, the Empress sends out a gardener and trim down the slack a little bit.
trim down the unfortunate observer, most likely. I think that the Shantin are so incredibly dependent upon the Soldam Damani for their prosperity and their ability to project their power in times of war and to control the populace and so forth and so on, in addition to the Ogier and stuff like that, that they would not want at all it to become widely known that Soldam could be taught to channel or are women who could be channelers, because then they would become Marath Damani, women who must be leashed, and then if they collar them on, then who is going to be Soldam for the Damani? They would pretty much eliminate the whole procedure. They might as well just kill all the Damani, because there would be nobody to control them if they leashed all the Soldam. And then they're giving away all their power. Basically, they would be going into our equivalent of nuclear detente, stepping down all of their Damani actions and so forth and so on, and have no more. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I guess my next question is, what are the Soldam and Damani's place going to be in the new Shanchan society now that there's going to be so much contact and presumably alliances, some of which may survive the last battle, you know, with the people of Rand's side of the world, the Aes Sedai, the kinswomen, you know, etc. I cannot imagine that Elaine and Egwene and Rand and all the people involved in it are going to tolerate that form of basically slavery, and I don't think the Shanchan are going to be too willing to give it up. But if there are going to be alliances, they're going to have to reach an accommodation, and it may be that it'll work out the way it did with the Aes Sedai and the Soldam and the former Damani and everything that were in Matt's Caravan and Valen Lucas show, where at some point in time they're just going to have to be done with the Aedam and presumably use channelers as semi-willing accomplices rather than complete slaves and unwilling allies.
I would have to say that I think that is really going to depend on what happens with Egwene's dreams and the Shanchan attacking the White Tower. I don't think that until those two main forces come together and battle it out, so to speak, that there will be any way to predict how the final world will be, as the post-breaking, post-Rand's breaking world will end up, with the Shanchan and the Aes Sedai and all of these different channelers kind of working together and or not.
I kind of had an idea, and I'm not sure how well this ends up playing out, but I kind of see the Aedam and the Soldam Damani relationship to progress, particularly under the Shanchan's particular desire for order and legal social stability, that the Aedam becomes the new Othrad. Rather than binding a person specifically on their ability to channel, to not do certain things, and at the same time shorten their lifespan, instead you lock them into the link of the bracelet and be made to use your abilities for the public good. And possibly in a new Age of Legends, as a form of law enforcement, you have criminals, or the criminally negligent, rather, being used to help erect new buildings, or to be used as a part of the police force itself.
Well, that's interesting, but I wonder, too, if they at some point in time decide that they can pretty much dispense with the Aedam, because there has always been slavery, and clearly, once some of these women have worn the Aedam for a long period of time, they actually want to continue to serve. They're afraid to be unleashed, but it may be that they can be convinced to be unleashed and still serve, but serve willingly, rather than under the control of a Soldam. It might be with the aid of a Soldam, which might satisfy the Egwene and White Tower faction if there is, in fact, going to be an alliance, which I think there may be. Because of Egwene's dream and a few other things, I believe that the Shanchan allying with the White Tower are going to be crucial in winning the last battle. I think they'll be a useful counterweight to the Ashaman.
I guess I have just never really thought that there could be an alliance between the White Tower and the Shanchan because of the Adam, and especially because of Ezhuin's own personal experience being collared. So I've always kind of seen that as a battle that will have to either take place before or during Tarmogaidon, but as something that's going to be a battle, not necessarily a uniting of those two forces against the Dark One.
But I think one of the constant themes through the Wheel of Time is that our characters always have lessons to learn. And even though they find things to be extremely distasteful or don't understand it or don't want to understand it, a lot of times they end up having to accept and integrate and move on. And it's just my particular theory, maybe it's a crazy theory, that partly because of the dreams and some other things that have been going on, that at some point in time, and because of Tuon, partly as well, I think there will be some form of alliance between the White Tower and a segment of the Shan Chan, at least. And my feeling is that Setala Anan will be a very crucial bridge between Tuon and Egwene, because she's very comfortable. Obviously, she's a former Aes Sedai, so she's very comfortable with the Aes Sedai. And Tuon has gotten very comfortable with her and enjoys conversation with her and discussions and arguments.
I had another sort of crazy theory, and I don't know if it's exactly crazy or if it's plausible or if it's neither, but I remember in an earlier podcast we were talking specifically about this dream of Egwene's, where actually there were two dreams, one of which was Aes Sedai being collared and forced to channel lightning against the White Tower itself, which I think in a way has technically already happened. I think that's an allusion to there being Aes Sedai collared and used in battle against the current sort of tower, or the current notion of Aes Sedai, which obviously the Shanshan started accomplishing at Fulme. But the other section of the dream being that Egwene is trying to climb Dragonmount, and at one point a Shanshan woman starts scaling down and reaches out a hand to help her and says, "We can make it to the top if we work together," or something to that particular effect. And I'm not now wondering if we are correct and Egwene is going to have a triumphant rise as the new Ammerlin, and Tuon, obviously, is now the Empress, might she live forever, if we don't have those two women represented there because of the fact, and I'm thinking here, Tuon greatly believes that in order to win the last battle, the Dragon Reborn must bow before the Crystal Throne. We've never actually known that not to be a prophecy. We assume that it is an altered version of the prophecies of the dragon put out by Ishmael during one of his escapes from the boar. We also know that Ilaida had a foretelling that said the Dragon Reborn would quake before the wrath of the Ammerlin, which she took to be herself, but might in fact be Egwene. Egwene's dream might be symbolizing that the Dragon Reborn, or even approaching or helping to control the Dragon Reborn, might be like trying to climb Dragonmount. You can't do it alone, but if you have two very important people, like the Empress and the Ammerlin Seat, working together, it might be possible to approach him and actually assert that control that is needed, in which case everyone then would be allowed to gain a measure of control necessary to win the last battle.
I have to agree with that. And one of the things that I've always thought was interesting is that the Shan Chan prophecy, as you mentioned, says that the Dragon Reborn must kneel before the Crystal Throne, whereas our version calls for Rand to bind the Nine Moons to serve him. So it appears that there's definitely got to be some communication there, and I just can't think it's coincidental that one of Rand's best friends, Matt, is now married to Tuon and is in fact the Prince of the Ravens, and that one of his other close friends that he grew up with, Egwene, is now the Ammerlin Seat. And between all of them, and then of course Perrin with his alliance now, tenuous as it is, I think there's got to be some grand scheme going on that will integrate all of those people and points of view. And strangely enough, I think that the Shan Chan might actually be instrumental in reuniting the White Tower in a new form.
I could definitely see that the Shan Chan would be instrumental in reuniting the White Tower. If the White Tower were suddenly to come under attack by the Shan Chan, it would be the reason that all of the Aes Sedai need to get out of their own way and actually make the tower whole again. And that was a very interesting theory, Andrew. I have to say I had interpreted the parts of that you had pieced together in a very different way myself. I had always thought that perhaps Rand, standing before the Ammerlin and knowing her wrath, or quaking before her, as it might be, I don't remember the exact line, maybe because of her anger at him over an alliance with the Seanchan. I think that Egwene would not be in the position she's in right now, having been collared at one point herself, if it wasn't going to be very important that she herself had been collared at one point. Whereas any Aes Sedai who has actually been collared and lived as a Dahmani for a time and then gotten away has a very different opinion of the Seanchan typically than the ones who think that this can be negotiated away or that some kind of alliance could be reached. And I think that that's going to have to play a very big role in whatever her, you know, obviously we're hoping that Egwene is going to come out on top as the Ammerlin, but in her role in that position, should she get there, that seems to be too important to have been just planted as for a, you know, kind of inconsequential, well, and she'll just get over that fact that they collared her and make an alliance for the good of the world and move on. I can't see her doing that.
I can see her doing that if necessity demands, because, again, like I say, our characters all seem to have lessons to learn, and that seems to be one that she might need to learn. I like your theory about that being the reason for the Ammerlin's wrath that Rand will face. I had always actually thought that would refer to the alleged compulsion that Rand used on the sisters in Carrion that swore fealty to him, and also the new trend of Ashaman bonding Aes Sedai and vice versa, because I think that that's going to send Egwene into orbit at some point in time as well. I forgot to mention my other crazy theory, which I think I did mention in a previous episode, that I think that Setala Anan is going to end up sticking with Tuon and perhaps being her new truth seeker, which I think would be pretty ironic, but she could be a very powerful agent for change. And I also think that Lyowyn, formerly Egwene, is also going to perform some function in being a liaison between the world of Shandar and Tuon and the world of Rand and Egwene.
I really like your theory about Setal. I can see that as very likely, and I think it would make me very happy. I think I'd enjoy that a lot.
Me too. I like Setal. She's a great character, and I'd certainly like to see her end up in a good way rather than some of the other people that we know have gone with the Seanchan, such as that horrible Rhonda Macura woman that found Forkroot. I'm not quite sure what her role is going to be with the Seanchan, but hopefully a lot of these things will be wrapped up in the next book. Well, another thing that I always thought was sort of interesting, going back to the Idom, there was at least one mention of the Imperial Court amusing itself by picking out random members of the blood, presumably the low blood or possibly the high blood, and attaching them to the bracelet part of an Idom with a Dahmani. And sometimes nothing would happen, but other times they would both die a horrible death, because evidently the man was one who could channel, like the Ashaman, you know, who never actually channeled but could have been taught to channel. And I just thought that was a weird thing to throw in there, and I'm wondering how that's going to play out. As my theory, knowing that Robert Jordan never puts anything in, and consequentially, I think it all means something.
Well, part of that establishes the idea that even touching the Adam, if you are a man who can channel, will cause searing pain for both of you, which kind of leads me to think that that is why Nynaeve had such a onrush of sickening emotions when she first touched the male Adam, is that they might not function exactly the same way, but I'm thinking they might possibly have that same sort of ill effect. But getting back to my original point, Rand has tried on one or two occasions to actually remove a collar from someone, and I do remember him getting that kind of shock or that sickening sensation that happened. It also seems to me that it kind of established the ruthlessness of the former Empress, and that it seemed less like, oh, this has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, and more like, yeah, the Empress just likes to pick out a random guy every now and then and slap the bracelet on him just to see if he'll die.
It does seem sort of a cruel amusement, doesn't it? But then I can certainly imagine the former empress, who did not live forever, entertaining herself that way. I mean, she made a couple of nobles' property just because they drunkenly had ravens tattooed on their shoulders. And she just busted them down to Dock of Ale. Not very nice people, most of them. I'm surprised Tuan's as nice as she is. And she's certainly got a hard core to her, but she doesn't seem to be maliciously cruel.
Unless you were related to her.
Well, considering some of her sisters and cousins and brothers, yeah.
I definitely think that Tuan can be maliciously cruel. I think that we haven't seen very many good examples of it yet. I think the best example so far would be her reaction to Suroth when she returns finally to, I think it's the Ibudar. And obviously everybody's so excited at that point when we read it, probably like me, that Suroth is finally getting what's coming to her. But I do think that Tuan has it in her to be maliciously cruel, and I think that we will see that definitely in Book 12.
Well, I really didn't think that was all that maliciously cruel, to be honest with you, considering what Suroth had done. Maybe that makes me maliciously cruel, too. But I thought she definitely didn't even get as much as she deserved. From what I understand, they have a lot worse ways to punish people than just busting them and throwing them to the Death Watch guards.
True, but that kind of hidden maliciousness, I do think I want to go back to something that was discussed earlier in our revisitation of the Forsaken episode, when it was suggested that maybe they should turn Semirog, who has been collared, over to Tuan.
Yeah, that was my suggestion, actually. I think that would be deliciously ironic. I'd love to see that. I mean, she certainly has every right to try and punish the woman, since she basically massacred her entire family. I'm sure there was little love lost between some of them, but I'm sure she cared, you know, for her mother and some of her other family members. So she appeared to care for her father and stuff like that. But yeah, I wouldn't have any problem with that whatsoever. I guess that does make me maliciously cruel, too. Oh, well.
I definitely have, over the course of the books, enjoyed the Soldam Damane invention, the introduction of this horribly terrifying and amazingly effective weapon that was created. And I mean, once again, you see evidence that Aes Sedai and Ahriman are living weapons in a way, and the Ogier Death Watch Guard are living weapons, and you have various beasts and whatnot, but it takes a new level of ingenuity on utilizing a person who can channel sheerly as a tool, and in most cases a horribly destructive tool. It does make mention in the White Book that they are not specifically just a war weapon, that they are also used to create structures, much in the way that the White Tower was constructed using the power, that the walls of the Black Tower were raised using the power. White Bridge is presumably created using the One Power. And the Shanshan do that as well. They do use them in that facet, but by and large, when you look at every weapon or beast or everything that is used by the Shanshan in their military campaigns, the Soldam and the Damane are just further than anything else, the sheerly most awesome weapon that they possibly have at their disposal. And I think it's just one of those things that has kept them as the ever-victorious army since the beginning.
Well, especially when you consider that the people that they are controlling are actually so powerful that if they weren't colored, they could certainly destroy them, you know, almost at will. So it really takes a lot of nerve, actually, to be leashing all these powerful channelers, when you think about it, and then using them for the most mundane of tasks, and including the weapon of war, as you mentioned. So, I don't know. It's an interesting system, and it's certainly very creative on Robert Jordan's part to come up with... Oh, well, that goes for everything in the Wheel of Time. It's just, it's such an amazing creation from start to finish, to this fully fleshed world that we're so interested in. So, does anybody else have any final thoughts on the Shanshan, Damani, and Soldam phenomenon? Do you think the institution will survive the last battle?
I particularly do. I really think that it's too much of an ingrained part of their society to be lost in such a short period of time. If it were to go away so suddenly, I would have to envision there being some sort of bleakness like the Aiel suffer when Rand takes away, essentially, their entire warrior past by revealing the true origins of the Aiel. And I just can't envision Jordan doing that to yet another race within the series. I really think that they will have to persist, and that even if they change, it'll probably be a good deal of time in coming.
I can't imagine that all those Demani wouldn't need a ton of counseling if they were suddenly unleashed. They all seem to think that they need and want to be leashed. I would like to think that the Shan-Chan and Demani will be present at the last battle and fighting against the Dreadlords and the Forsaken. I think they'd be a very powerful asset to all the Chandlers on this side of the world, and I can't help but believe that the last battle is basically going to be in the hands of Chandlers to win or lose. I don't think the arms and armor segment is going to be more than incidental in winning the last battle.
I definitely think that the institution of Sul'dam and Demani will persist post-Tarmon Gaidon. I don't know what that relationship will be or how that will interact with the rest of either Rand's world, this side of the ocean, or the other side in Sandar, but it definitely seems like, I would agree with what Andrew said, that this is too much a part of their culture and too much a part of their institution that they would be able to completely relinquish it. So I think it's going to have to merge into a kind of maybe a new institution, but I think that ultimately it's going to stay there. I mean, Rand is prophesized to break all bonds, so it's probably going to get chopped up a bit, but I think that ultimately it will stay there. And I definitely think that Demani are going to need to be present at the last battle, absolutely, to fight the Dreadlords. I don't know if I would agree with what you said about the rest of the regular soldiers being as important, because I think that, like somebody said at one point in the series, that the last battle will come with hordes of Trollocs. And I'm definitely expecting there to be hordes of Trollocs, even more than, an army of Demani by themselves could battle. So I think that's going to be really interesting. Can't wait for it.
Yeah, me too. I wonder, the thought just occurred to me, do you think there's any possibility that Egwene, with her desire to integrate all Chandlers in whatever form that she can into the White Tower, the way that she did with the Knitting Circle and the Kinswoman, do you think there's any way that she might form an alliance with the Shan-Chan, Sul'dam, and Demani to have them allied in some fashion in their present form or some modified form with the White Tower? She seems to be really good at this sort of thing.
It would not surprise me in the slightest to learn that she's thought of a plan for it, but I would suspect that she may be willing to accept that the Demani do not necessarily themselves want to be free, but I really cannot picture the Aes Sedai and Rand side of the ocean and Egwene herself being able to get over the deplorable thing that the Shan-Chan have done. As you know, it's more distasteful than compulsion. It's essentially stripping a human being of their humanity, and I don't think that she's going to be able to get over that one real quickly. So, I don't know. I think it's going to be interesting, and that's one I don't think I could really even speculate on. I think she's probably got a plan, something that will involve, as you said, she wants to unite all of the channelers in the world with the tower. But I don't know how she's going to come up with that and do it in a way that would still be acceptable to the current Shan-Chan way of thinking and their current culture.
Well, what made me think of it was the current alliance, which is sanctioned by Egwene, between the rebel Aes Sedai and the Ashaman, and then, of course, Rand's side of it with the Ashaman and the Aes Sedai, so that they can bond each other to the level of equality now that it's been done, so that they can achieve parity. In other words, 51 Aes Sedai or 57 Aes Sedai were bonded by Ashaman, so the vice versa can happen, and so on and so forth. And even though they hate the idea, and in very fact, the idea of a man channeling was, I think it was Samitsu who was saying, how quickly the horror of yesterday becomes the commonplace of today. I mean, only months ago, the very idea of a man channeling was enough to give most Aes Sedai fits, or if they were red, have them tearing off to go gentle him. And now they're not only tolerating them, but they're bonding them and being bonded by them. So, I mean, there are a lot of changes going on, Don't know if that one's going to be able to happen or not, but would be interesting to see what does. So I think that pretty much wraps up this episode of The Fourth Age. We've had a lot of fun discussing the Shan Chan with their Damani and Soldam, and we'd like to thank everybody for joining us with our discussion. We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. We're always open to listener feedback, and if you want to reach us, there are a number of ways you can do so.
We love hearing from everyone. If you have any thoughts on the Soldam and Damani, maybe we've hit upon something you really liked, maybe you have some of your own theories about what's going to happen with them or how their association works or any of that sort of stuff, your own crazy theories, ideas, criticisms, or accolades, you know, go ahead and you can give us an email at podcast@dragonmount.com. Read everything that comes to us and are very willing to take time out from episodes to go back and discuss points that are brought up about previous episodes. If you also like, you can leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690. We listen to pretty much all of our voice feedback, and in that way, sometimes you can get your voice actually on a show with us. We always love hearing from everyone and everything. With the possible slight exceptions, every now and then we'll get a slight comment about our pronunciation, and we just like to remind everyone that this expansive universe has over 140,000 names of people, places, and things, and none of us are perfect. We are all fans, and we absolutely will make mistakes. And so every now and then we have our own way of pronouncing things that we're just kind of set in stone on. But aside from that, we love hearing pretty much anything that comes from the listening audience. So feel free to drop us a phone message or an email. In addition, we also have our MySpace page, which is www.myspace.com/fourthage. Our sometimes podcaster friend Morgan is updating the blog on that and keeping us updated with everything that's going on there.
Thanks, Andrew, and thank you, Jesse, for joining us for this episode. It's been a blast, as always. I love doing this, and I hope the listeners enjoy it as much as I know we do. So, for myself, Virginia, I would like to say good day, good night, whatever time it is when you're listening to this, and may the light illumine you.
And to all the listeners out there, I'd just like to say thank you very much. We so enjoy having the opportunity to discuss our favorite series with you all, and hope you enjoy listening, and keep reading.
And for myself, Andrew Gallows, on behalf of all the podcasters here at The Fourth Age, to all fans of The Wheel of Time, Saravyaninto Manshima Taishite. This is why we have editors.
Yeah, no kidding. Can you imagine if this was live?
the pump, the hump, the presser,